Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 190. It's Monday, December 12th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, you know, we're all tired of COVID and infectious respiratory diseases. But once again, the headlines, this from CNN. Hospitals in the U.S. are the fullest they've been throughout the pandemic, but it's not just COVID. Hospitals are more full than they've been throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a CNN analysis of data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But as respiratory virus season surges across the U.S., it's much more than COVID that's filling beds this year. More than 80% of hospital beds are in use nationwide, jumping 8 percentage points in the last 2 weeks. Hospitals have been required to report capacity information since mid-2020 as part of a federal effort to track the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Hospitals have been more than 70% full for the vast majority of that time, but they've been 80% full at only one other point, in January, during the height of the Omicron surge in the U.S. Back in January, about a quarter of hospital beds were in use for COVID patients. But now, only about 6% of beds are in use for COVID patients, according to the HHS data. The broader respiratory virus season is in full swing across the U.S. All but six states are experiencing high or very high respiratory virus as seasonal flu activity remains high and continues to increase, according to the CDC. The number of people admitted to the hospital for flu during the week of Thanksgiving was nearly double the number of admissions during the week before, and the latest surveillance data probably does not reflect the full effects of the holiday gatherings, as it captures only through November 26, 2 days past Thanksgiving. As of last Thursday, about 10% of hospitals are reporting a critical staff shortage. Wow, so you go way back and remember the old flattening the curve? And what was the purpose of flattening the curve? Was to spare hospitals and healthcare providers. Well, folks, we have taxed it even more than the various peaks and spikes that we've had with COVID-19. So the other respiratory infectious diseases, RSV and flu, are capable of doing a lot of damage as well. And we're seeing all three of them, especially combined, high. RSV seems to be coming down a bit, but flu is raging and COVID is on the rise. So, you know, it is interesting how we've kind of evolved or devolved, as the case may be, is, you know, now that cases aren't a reliable way to even track COVID, because so few are actually even reported to public health authorities. That it's not a reliable indicator of really what's going on. And so we move to hospitalizations. We'll do mitigation efforts when there's hospitalizations. Well, folks, we've pinned the hospitalizations to the highest it's been during the entire pandemic. Are we hearing peeps about mask wearing? Yes, in some big cities we actually are. And some school systems are encouraging it too. But as a whole in the country, you can pretty much hear a pin drop, and traveling around Toledo here in holiday season, you don't see a lot of masks in crowded public spaces. Wear good quality masks in public spaces when you are shopping or out and about. That is good for both the flu, for RSV, and COVID. That's good for everybody, particularly our vulnerable, which include elderly, the young folks, youngest folks, and those that are immunocompromised. We can do better, folks. And the next story gets to how well we may be vaccinating the youngest, or not vaccinating, but this is a little bit of progress here from the Hill. CDC expands use of updated COVID-19 vaccines for kids as young as 6 months. The CDC has signed off on the use of bivalent COVID-19 vaccines for children aged 6 months through 5 years. The move, following the FDA green light last week, allows the updated vaccines to be administered to the youngest population starting immediately. While the vaccines are authorized in adults as a booster only, it's a little more complicated for young kids. Children ages 6 months through 5 years who previously completed a two-dose Moderna primary series are eligible to receive a Moderna bivalent booster 2 months after their final primary series dose. Children aged 6 months to 4 years who are currently completing a three-dose Pfizer primary series will receive a Pfizer bivalent vaccine as their third primary dose. The vaccine authorization comes amid a rise in COVID infections as well as one of the earliest surges of influenza. The youngest children have only been eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine since June, making them the last group to become eligible for vaccination. But the vast majority of children in this age group have not received any doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, which is worrying administration health officials. The CDC says it's working to increase parent and provider confidence in COVID vaccines and improve uptake among the 95% of children who either are not vaccinated or who have not yet completed the primary series. COVID-19 vaccines remain our best defense against the most devastating health consequences of the virus, and we encourage all of those eligible to stay up to date with their vaccinations or get vaccinated if they have not yet done so. So only about 1 in 7 adults have gotten the bivalent booster, the most recent one, to keep updated. And even more shockingly, only 1 in 3 of those over age 65 have gotten the new booster. That could be trouble. Well, folks, I guess if you're from the anti-vax forces, you could consider that a big win. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up in the continuing coverage of the measles outbreak in Columbus, this from ABC News. At least 63 children are sick with the measles in Ohio. An ongoing measles outbreak in central Ohio has ballooned to 63 cases as of last Thursday. 25 children have been hospitalized. 3 of the 63 children have received one dose of the measles, mumps, and rubella MMR vaccine, a highly effective vaccine that protects against the 3 diseases. The remaining 60 children are unvaccinated. The majority of the children are under 5 years old. The CDC recommends that all children get 2 doses of the MMR vaccine, the first when they're 12 to 15 months old and the second when they're 4 to 6 years old. One dose is 93% effective against measles, and two doses are 97% effective. The children affected by the Ohio outbreak appear to be unvaccinated because their families rejected the vaccine, not because they had delays in their vaccinations as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Columbus Health Department offers the vaccine at its clinic, but the department hasn't seen any uptick in the number of people seeking out the MMR vaccine in response to the outbreak, officials said. It's still not clear how large this outbreak could become. The health department doesn't have good visibility into the percentage of people who are vaccinated against measles in the state of Ohio. The health department is working with the CDC, insurance providers, and medical providers to get a better estimate of that number. Once we get that information about the population here in central Ohio, the CDC is optimistic to be able to get us an estimate of how large this outbreak could get. But at this point, just looking at past outbreaks in other communities, we're just hoping that we don't get as large as some of those. Now, the new thing added about this expanding outbreak is that a few of the new cases have been in people who received one of the doses of MMR. So it's not 100% effective, but it's 93% effective with one dose and 97% effective at two doses. But measles is extremely infectious. And of course, the overwhelming majority, 95% of those that are infected, are unvaccinated, which fits up with the effectiveness of the doses. But when you have cases out there, if you're in the presence of measles and you're unvaccinated, you get about a 95% chance of being infected. Highly contagious. A good idea to keep up on all your vaccinations, but the MMR, particularly important there for you in Central Ohio, and to avoid these problems in the future, everywhere, people. Okay, well, that last story ended with not really knowing what the status is of immunization is in Central Ohio, so it's kind of hard to predict where things are going to go. That's a problem this next story gets at, this from Stat News. CDC Director Walensky says the CDC needs more authority from Congress to collect public health data. The CDC needs Congress to help it collect more data from state, local, and tribal public health departments, Director Rochelle Walensky said last Wednesday. There have been numerous pieces written about how the CDC is not sharing the data on X, and I just say, boy, I'd love to share the data on X. I'd love to have the data on X so I can share it with you, Walensky said at the Milk and Future of Health Summit. Walensky visited Capitol Hill in an effort to advocate for the new authority, she said. Lawmakers are negotiating an end-of-year package to fund the government and potentially accomplish other priorities. One example she gave of the CDC's current data limitations is that in the agency's first report on Mpox, the agency had race data only on 23% of cases. She also said it took 2 months to work with 61 jurisdictions to settle on data sharing agreements for Mpox vaccine administration data, even in the midst of a public health emergency, which left the government with no visibility into how a scarce resource was being distributed. Ending the COVID-19 public health emergency, which could conclude as early as next year, will make it even harder. The context of the public health emergency allows us a little more flexibility to see those data, Walensky said. In 2 years, will I be able to report on COVID-19 community levels? I can't tell you that. So this is one of the things that's happening with the ending of the public health emergency and funding, is that these increased efforts in data collection are falling away. But hold on, there are some improvements in this arena. This from NPR. The White House unveils a new system to track and better prevent opioid overdoses. For decades, the U.S. struggled to create a national system for tracking opioid overdoses. Critics, including Representative David Trone, say the lack of accurate real-time data has made it harder for health officials to respond as black market pain pills, heroin, and illicit fentanyl flooded communities. It is absolutely a monstrous failure of government, Trone said in an interview with NPR. The excuses are unending. Last Thursday, the Biden administration moved to close the data gap, unveiling a new website that will track non-fatal opioid overdoses. The site will be updated every 2 weeks with reports collected at the county level by EMS first responders in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Officials say the information will help shape the medical response when overdose clusters occur in different parts of the country. That could include quickly distributing naloxone, a medication that reverses opioid overdoses, in communities facing a rise in overdose incidents. We could see tens of thousands of additional lives saved, said Dr. Rahul Gupta, head of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. According to Gupta, the website will provide first responders, clinicians, and policymakers with real-time, actionable information that will improve our responses. This comes as the overdose crisis hit a deadly new record last year, with the CDC reporting over 107,000 drug deaths. Gupta said many of those deaths could have been prevented with better information and better, more targeted addiction treatment. Data on the new website will be managed by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which collects EMS data. Officials acknowledge that data collection and reporting systems will provide a limited snapshot of drug overdoses. It focuses entirely on opioids, the leading cause of drug deaths, while excluding cocaine, methamphetamines, and other substances. The website also won't include information from hospitals, schools, businesses, nonprofits, and academic programs that collect non-fatal overdose information. This does not include every part of all the overdoses that occur, Gupta said. This is the beginning of a system build-out. He said the data collection system would improve over time. Despite its limitations, some addiction experts praise the new program. I think it's a big step and an important first step, said Aaron Artigiani with the Center for Substance Abuse Research at the University of Maryland. I think it's crucial to have complete and relatively real-time data. That's something researchers and policymakers alike have been talking about for some time. The stakes for this initiative are high. A study released this year by the medical journal The Lancet predicted the U.S. will see another 1.2 million opioid overdose deaths by the end of this decade. Okay, next up, let's do a story connected to the holiday season. This from Axios. False holiday suicide myth is driven by media, analysis says. The perception that the suicide rate rises with the holiday season is a myth, driven by false media narratives, the Annenberg Public Policy Center said in an analysis released last Monday. Why it matters? Allowing people to think that suicide is more likely this time of year can have a contagious effect on people who are contemplating taking their lives. What did they find? While the holiday blues, seasonal affective disorder, and other factors can make this a difficult time of year, the average number of U.S. suicide deaths per day last January and December put those 2 months among the lowest of the 12 months. August had the highest, according to the CDC. Just over half of the news stories that the Annenberg Public Policy Center analyzed from the 2021 to 2022 holiday season that discuss holidays and suicide supported the false myth. More coverage has supported the false connection that debunked it since they began tracking coverage of the subject in 1999 and 2000 holiday season. In fact, in preparing for the show this week, I ran across a story that in fact reinforced this myth. I'm not reporting on that story. Next up, a couple stories on pregnant women. This from the New York Times. The COVID pandemic's hidden casualties, pregnant women. Of all the groups still threatened by COVID-19, including the elderly and immunocompromised, it is pregnant women who seem the most unaware of the risk. COVID can kill pregnant women and can result in miscarriage, preterm births, and stillbirths, even when the women have asymptomatic or mild disease. The infection may also affect the baby's brain development. Dozens of studies have shown that the COVID vaccine is safe for pregnant women. Immunization of the mother also passes along protective antibodies to her fetus. Yet only 70% of women have completed the primary vaccination series for COVID before or during pregnancy, meaning that roughly 30% of pregnant women have not had this basic protection. Since early September, only 15% have opted for a booster shot. Even the flu vaccine has not proven popular with pregnant women this year. Just 37% of pregnant women have been vaccinated for flu as of the end of October, compared with nearly 60% at the end of September 2020. And next up from MedPage Today, drug overdose deaths in pregnancy rose 81% in recent years. Drug overdose deaths in pregnancy or the postpartum period increased sharply in the U.S. in recent years, with the rise most pronounced at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, researchers reported. From 2017 to 2020, overdose deaths in this population rose 81%. By comparison, overdose deaths among non-pregnant females of reproductive age increased 38%. Deaths involving benzodiazepines, heroin, and prescription opioids in pregnant or postpartum individuals were mostly stable from 2017 to 2020, but there was a large 65% increase in deaths involving fentanyl and other synthetics and psychostimulants such as methamphetamine and cocaine. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Next up, for those of you who are old enough to remember the tobacco settlement a couple decades ago, this from the Washington Times. Big tobacco brands must display signs in stores explaining risks of smoking, per Justice Department. America's big tobacco companies will now be required to produce and display signage in stores explaining the risks of smoking, the Justice Department announced last Tuesday. The order was the last of a set of corrective remedies mandated by a 1999 Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO lawsuit, filed by the government. The 2005 verdict in that trial determined that cigarette companies had defrauded consumers about the health dangers associated with cigarette smoking. Justice Department attorneys have worked diligently for over 20 years to hold accountable the tobacco companies that defrauded consumers about the health risks of smoking. This resolution implements the last remedy of this litigation, said Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta. The order primarily affects some 200,000 stores that have agreements with the four companies. Now those agreements are required to be amended to display the smoking risk signs. The signs must be in color to attract attention. Warnings required on the display include: smoking cigarettes causes numerous diseases and 1,200 American deaths on average every day. Cigarettes have been designed to create and sustain nicotine addiction. So-called light, low-tar, and natural cigarettes are just as harmful as regular cigarettes. Secondhand smoke causes disease and death in people who do not smoke. The signs will not be permanent. The order will take effect July 1st with a three-month grace period for the defendants who had the signs displayed. The signs required to be in English and Spanish will be up for 21 months after that. The two-year duration of the warning signage was the result of negotiations between retailers, the defendants, and the government, which settled on the 24-month range in May 2022. America's health leaders applauded the latest strike against smoking. Smoking causes about 30% of all cancer deaths in the United States, and therefore the court-ordered corrective statements appearing at the point of cigarette sale will help support our mission to reduce the burden of cancer, said National Cancer Institute Behavioral Research Program Associate Director William Klein. Well, of course, everybody's aware that smoking is a major cause of cancer deaths, but what not as many people are aware of, that actually smoking causes more deaths from cardiovascular disease than it causes from cancer. And overall in the country, cancer deaths and cardiovascular deaths are about even, about neck and neck. Actually, cardiovascular beats it out just a little bit. So remember that smoking prevents cardiovascular disease as well. And, of course, one of the big purveyors of that, big tobacco.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, next up, a story about how for-profit, market-based healthcare does not work well for promoting the health of the entire population. This from Kaiser Health News. Hospital financial decisions play a role in the critical shortage of pediatric beds for RSV patients. The dire shortage of pediatric hospital beds plaguing the nation this fall is a byproduct of financial decisions made by hospitals over the past decade as they shuttered children's wards, which often operate in the red, and expanded the number of beds available for more profitable endeavors like joint replacements and cancer care. To cope with the flood of young patients sickened by a sweeping convergence of nasty bugs, especially RSV, influenza, and COVID, medical centers nationwide have deployed triage tents, delayed elective surgeries, and transferred critically ill children out of state. A major factor in the bed shortage is a years-long trend among hospitals of eliminating pediatric units, which tend to be less profitable than adult units, said Mark Wiateka, CEO of the Children's Hospital Association. Hospitals optimize revenue by striving to keep their beds 100% full and filled with patients whose conditions command generous insurance reimbursements. The number of pediatric inpatient units in hospitals fell 19% from 2008 to 2018, according to a study published in 2021 in the journal Pediatrics. Just this year, hospitals have closed pediatric units in Boston and Springfield, Massachusetts, Richmond, Virginia, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. When intensive care units were flooded with older COVID patients in 2020, some hospitals began using children's beds to treat adults. Many of those pediatric beds haven't been restored, said Daniel Rausch, chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Hospital Care. In addition, the relentless pace of the pandemic has spurred more than 230,000 healthcare providers, including doctors, nurses, and physician assistants, to quit. Before the pandemic, about 10% of nurses left their jobs every year. That rate has risen to about 20%. Pediatric hospitals are unable to maintain as many as 10% of their beds because of staffing shortages. You can have a bed, but if you don't have somebody to staff it, it isn't any good. There's not great money in treating kids. About 40% of U.S. children are covered by Medicaid, a joint federal-state program for low-income patients and people with disabilities. Base Medicaid rates are typically more than 20% below those paid by Medicare, the government insurance program for older adults, and are even lower when compared with private insurance. While specialty care for a range of common adult procedures, from knee and hip replacements to heart surgeries and cancer treatments, generates major profits for medical centers, hospitals complain they typically lose money on inpatient pediatric care. Rausch noted that children's hospitals, which specialize in treating rare and serious conditions such as pediatric cancer, cystic fibrosis, and heart defects, simply aren't designed to handle this season's crush of kids acutely ill with respiratory bugs. Even before the autumn's viral trifecta, pediatric units were straining to absorb rising numbers of young people in acute mental distress. Stories abound of children in mental crises being marooned for weeks in emergency departments while awaiting transfer to a pediatric psychiatric unit. Unless there is a radical change in how we pay for pediatric hospital care, the bed shortage is only going to get worse. Of course, many of the perverse incentives of for-profit market-based healthcare could be overcome by single-payer healthcare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, next up, I want to do a story that's a somewhat of a follow-up to a commentary extended piece that I did on CAT scans when the radiation risks of those. So this from MedPage Today. Higher brain cancer risk after CAT scan, CT exam in childhood. There has been an escalating risk of brain cancer associated with increasing radiation dose to the brain from CT examinations, a cohort study of more than 650,000 children and young adults indicated. Researchers observed a significant dose-response relationship, such that for every 10,000 people who received a single head CAT scan, approximately one patient developed brain cancer attributable to radiation exposure in the 5 to 15 years following the examination. To put this finding in context, the number of pediatric head CAT scan examinations per year during the past decade probably exceeds 1 million in the European Union and 5 million in the USA, they reported in The Lancet Oncology. Only a small fraction of the attributable brain cancers might be preventable, that is, those with unnecessarily high doses during CT examinations or the presumably larger group with clinically unjustified CAT scan examinations. Nevertheless, these figures emphasize the need to adhere to the basic radiological protection principles in medicine, namely justification, that is, procedures are appropriate and comply with guidelines, and optimization, that is, doses are as low as reasonably achievable. Indeed, CT use has already declined in recent years amid efforts to both justify and optimize these exams, according to Nobuyuki Hamada, radiation epidemiologist of University of California, San Francisco. Such continued efforts, along with extended epidemiological investigations, would be needed to minimize the risk of brain cancer after pediatric CAT scan examination. So, this doesn't mean don't ever get a CAT scan, but it means CAT scans do offer risk. In this case, another study showing a significant increase in brain cancer risk. So, for the 5 million CT scans done among kids in the U.S. each year, that would be about 50 brain cancers caused by that diagnostic method. So, to factor that in.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, another story in the seemingly unending series of bad stories on gun violence. This from Medical Express. U.S. gun death rates hit highest levels in decades. The U.S. gun death rate last year hit its highest mark in nearly three decades, and the rate among women has been growing faster than that of men, according to a new study. The increase among women, most dramatically in black women, is playing a tragic and under-recognized role in a tally that skews overwhelmingly male. Women can get lost in the discussion because so many of the fatalities are men, said one of the co-authors, Dr. Eric Flieger of Harvard Medical School. Among black women, the rate of firearm-related homicides more than tripled since 2010, and the rate of gun-related suicides more than doubled since 2015, Flieger and his co-authors wrote in the paper published in JAMA Network Open. The research is one of the most comprehensive analyses of U.S. gun deaths in years, said David Hemenway, director of the Harvard University's Injury Control Research Center. In October, the CDC released data on U.S. firearm deaths last year, counting more than 47,000, the most in at least 40 years. The U.S. population is growing, but researchers say the rate of gun deaths has been getting worse, too. America's gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, each hitting levels not seen since the early 1990s. In the new study, the researchers examined trends in firearm deaths since 1990. They found gun deaths began to steadily increase in 2005, but the rise accelerated recently, with a 20% jump from 2019 to 2021. Why did gun deaths rise so dramatically during the COVID-19 pandemic?
That's a straightforward question with probably a complicated answer that no one really knows the answer to, said Flieger, an emergency medicine physician at Boston Children's Hospital. Factors could include disruption of people's work and personal lives, higher gun sales, stress, and mental health issues, experts said. The researchers counted more than 1.1 million gun deaths over those 32 years, about the same number of American deaths attributed to COVID-19 in the last 3 years. About 14% of those killed by guns were women, but the rate increase among them is more pronounced. There were about 7 gun deaths per 100,000 women last year, up from about 4 per 100,000 in 2010, an increase of 71%. The comparable increase for men was 45%. The highest homicide gun death rates continue to be in young black men, at 142 per 100,000 for those in their early 20s. The highest gun suicide death rates are in white men in their early 80s, at 45 per 100,000, the researchers said. In a commentary accompanying the study, three University of Michigan researchers said the paper confirmed racial and sexual differences in U.S. gun deaths and that homicide deaths are concentrated in cities and suicides are more common in rural areas. Okay, well, trying to find good news in the gun violence arena isn't that easy, but here is one that's some good news, this from Medical Express. Repairing abandoned houses found to reduce nearby gun violence. Installing new doors and windows, trash cleanup, and weeding at abandoned houses in Philadelphia led to substantial drops in nearby gun violence, according to a new study published in JAMA Internal Medicine. The findings suggest that fixing dilapidated, abandoned houses is an inexpensive intervention that local governments can add to their prevention efforts to address the current gun violence crisis. Decades of disinvestment due to structural racism has led to the physical deterioration of many segregated black urban neighborhoods, said Eugenia South, an assistant professor of emergency medicine and faculty director at the Penn Urban Health Lab and lead author of the study. Abandoned houses often have crumbling facades, blown out windows, doors covered with plywood, and the accumulation of trash on the property. Our study highlights how those houses have implications far beyond just the aesthetics of a neighborhood, and how simple structural fixes to these homes can make the neighborhood safer and, by extension, the people healthier. Research shows that abandoned houses can impact the health and safety of the neighborhoods in which they are located in a number of ways. For instance, abandoned houses are often easy to enter and can be a location of legal activity, including the storage of firearms. A concentration of abandoned houses has been associated with violence and substance use. Residents often point to these spaces as fracturing social ties between neighbors and contributing to poor mental health. For this study, which began in June 2017 and completed in February 2020, abandoned houses across the city of Philadelphia were randomly selected and allocated into one of three trial arms. The first group received a full remediation, including new window and door installations, trash cleanup, and weeding. The second group received trash cleanup and weeding only. The third group received no intervention at all and served as a control. In total, 258 abandoned houses were included in the study. The neighborhoods where the study took place were predominantly black and low income. The trash cleanup intervention included removal of debris and weeding in front of the house, including the sidewalk, and reporting graffiti to the city for removal. Maintenance was performed for houses in the first two groups every 2.5 months on average, which included reinstalling stolen windows and doors at 10 houses. This citywide randomized control trial is a powerful piece of scientific evidence showing that place-based interventions can improve health and safety, even for some of the most challenging crises like gun violence, said Charles Branis, chair of the Department of Epidemiology at Columbia University. This is the first time that the effects of abandoned house remediation have been studied in a truly scientific manner, and opens the door for more academic research that can provide policymakers with concrete evidence that these interventions work and should be seriously considered. Blocks around the homes that received the full intervention showed an 8% reduction in monthly weapons violations, a 13% reduction in gun assaults, and a 7% reduction in shootings after the intervention compared to blocks around the control houses. The blocks around the homes that only received trash cleanup and weeding showed no change in gun violence compared to control houses. The authors also evaluated the impact of abandoned house remediation on illegal substance use and trafficking using police data and found no reliable impact for any intervention. This publication adds to the growing body of research by the authors that illustrates the efficacy of place-based interventions, such as vacant lot cleaning and greening and structural repairs to homes in low-income neighborhoods, in improving health and safety in predominantly black neighborhoods. While abandoning housing remediation does not directly address the policies leading to segregation, disinvestment, and poor health in poor black neighborhoods, our research suggests that such an intervention does influence upstream contributors to gun violence, said John McDonald, a professor of criminology at the University of Pennsylvania and principal investigator for the study. These results are promising and warrant further research into home repairs and their impact on crime and perceived safety in low-income neighborhoods. So this is an example of what's been around for a long time called the broken windows hypothesis, basically saying that you get a downward spiral. If people have houses in poor conditions in their neighborhood, they tend to take less well care of their own home. You know, kid going along sees a broken window is more likely to break another window if one's already broken, et cetera, et cetera. And this is really the first I've seen of a randomized controlled trial of this. And it's good to see that it has some positive effect. Of course, getting at the structural problems of racism, redlining, and poor communities would be also a very good structural implementation. But this is something that may be more of a bite size that local policymakers can take hold of. Okay, well, that brings us to a portion of the Just for the Health of It bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. We have 14 bonus articles this week. Number one, poll shows few COVID worries for the holidays. So even though we've pinned out the amount of hospitalizations due to a respiratory infectious disease, people don't seem to show a lot of worries about the holidays, so take it for its worth. And there's a lot of good background information about attitudes about COVID in that if you want to check it out. Article 2, for the uninsured, COVID care has entered a new stage of crisis. So this is because we have ending pandemic funding, so that's drying up, as well as it looks like we're going to see an end early next year in the status of the declaration of a public health emergency, and that ending will change a number of pandemic provisions. They're going away. And of course, the brunt of that will fall on the most vulnerable. Article 3, CDC report shows how infectious Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, is and how important vaccination was in stemming the outbreak. So this is just another evidence, the fact that vaccinations really work, and that by doing ring vaccination, I mean vaccinating people either in very high-risk communities or directly around those people that are known to have been infected, it was very effective in stemming the outbreak. Article 4, should doctors warn patients about the downsides of Medicare Advantage plans? Beneficiaries may not be aware of plans' limited networks or prior authorization rules. So this is in my continuing coverage of how nasty Medicare Advantage is. It's a problem for individuals, as this article gets at, and why physicians probably, I think the answer is yes, that they should warn patients, talk to their patients about what it means, because you could have a patient coming in who, you know, says, oh, I've switched to a new Medicare Advantage plan, and the doctors say, well, I'm not in that network, because these are privately run networks that are paid with public dollars, but they're privately run. So it's not traditional Medicare, which most every provider will take. So have to check to see if your providers are in. And even if they are in, those Medicare Advantage plans can change those provider networks at any time. You can only change once a year during open enrollment, which just ended. Okay. Article 5, Congress, close the gap between funding for nutrition research and the toll diet-related disease takes on Americans. So if doctors want to talk about something, they should talk about what they know about. That may be Medicare Advantage plans. It's probably not diet. But since diet, compared to actually compared to tobacco, diet actually affects more health outcomes than tobacco does. Although I think it's fair to say that as a single preventative measure, getting rid of tobacco use is the single best thing you can do to improve your health. Since diet is really a bunch of behaviors, it doesn't quite really compare well. But if you add all those diet-related behaviors together, diet actually has a bigger effect than stopping tobacco, assuming that you're moving in the positive direction. But this article is getting at the fact that the federal government's approach to nutrition research is very fragmented and underfunded. And this is basically a follow-up of that nutrition conference or summit that they had a couple months ago. And in more congressional news, Article 6, Congress has its sights set too low on addiction advocates charge. So as we end another Congress, but the opioid epidemic has actually been something that at least the talking points have been very bipartisan. But when it actually comes down to legislation, it hasn't really panned out. In fact, in this Congress, there has, in the 2 years of the Biden administration, there has been no major legislation about stopping the opioid epidemic. Whether they can do something at all before this Congress ends remains to be seen, but we can set the bar higher. Article 7, why does the U.S. keep running out of medicine? So this is another piece of that story of how market-based for-profit healthcare doesn't work very well in population health. This kind of, guessing how much is needed and making sure that you have in-time delivery and stuff. That's nice from a business model, but it's not very good from a public health model. It's better off from a public health model to have a little bit of extra capacity built in so that when you have unanticipated surges that you can cover them and prevent these little crises, which often end up causing some of the most damage in a short period of time. Okay, bonus Article 8. Public health leaders question whether asbestos facilities should be exempt from surprise inspections. This almost seems like a really no-brainer, and the American Public Health Association is pushing this. Asbestos is one of the most dangerous materials to be working around and using, and there's an exception for asbestos facilities. These are chlorine processing facilities, and actually you don't even have to use asbestos in these chlorine processing facilities, but somehow they're exempt from surprise inspections. This is something that should change, a regulatory improvement. Bonus Article 9. Before making unbiased pulse oximeters, researchers need a better way to measure skin tone. So I've reported over this last year or so of the fact that people with darker skin have inaccurate readings on these pulse oximeters. And of course, that's really important, like in COVID-19 and other respiratory distress issues where you get low oxygen, and people that have darker skin, it doesn't read it accurately. But here, what they're getting at with this article is that they're using race as a proxy, but they're not actually measuring skin tone. So it's kind of a convenience of the research to be able to measure race. But really what we need to do is, rather than racialize this, we just need to take skin tone as another biological measure that we need to take into account when we're making diagnoses. Bonus Article 10. A boil water notice in Houston made national news. In rural Texas, it's a way of life. So this is my ongoing series of everything is big in Texas, including public health problems. So in rural Texas, a lot of these smaller towns and counties, their water systems are, like a lot of infrastructure in Texas, yikes, not doing so well, on the brink. And many places in rural Texas, you get boil water notices with regularity. Bonus Article 11. For black families in Phoenix, child welfare investigations are a constant threat. So Phoenix, or specifically Maricopa County, has the highest rate of child welfare investigations of any of the large metro areas in the U.S. Basically, almost two-thirds of black families will be investigated at some point, and one in three families over the recent five-year period before the pandemic.
Article 12. And now they are coming for the unhoused. The long push to expand involuntary treatment in America. This is a good backgrounder if you want to understand the background behind what just happened in New York City, where Mayor Eric Adams wants to push for the involuntary commitment of homeless people. And this is another kind of overreach in regulation that is classist, racist, and it's a good duo with the earlier story about child welfare and investigations. Public health, of course, relies on a lot of good regulation, but when you have bad regulation or unfair implementation of different regulations, it can lead to a lot of problems. Bonus Article 13. Here's how states plan to limit abortion, even where it is already banned. So I've reported a lot on this, but this is a good kind of listing of all the various ways that states are continuing to try to restrict abortion access. And last but not least, one that you can use for your own individual health, bonus Article 14, household air purifiers improve heart health among individuals with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And when they mean air purifiers here, they mean those HEPA filters, the best ones. So this is good news for those that already have a respiratory condition. But as I reported on, air quality, whether indoors or outdoors, is a huge driver of health. So if you happened to spend a lot of time in one place, in your home or office, and doesn't really matter actually whether it's enclosed or open. If you have an open office space, even if you put one of these little air purifiers next to you, it can actually increase the air quality around you quite a bit. So there's your personal health tip for the day. You can view this and all the articles I've reported on in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And if you're interested in sending them in any comments or things you'd like to be reported on, you can contact me at WAKT@toppun.com. That's WAKT@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-